Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I am Aaron Flam. You're listening to Deconstructive Criticism. In this episode, we talk to reservist Brigadier General Meir Finkel about the war in Gaza, a coming war in Lebanon, and occupying territory. But first, a heartfelt thank you for listening to Deconstructive Criticism, and an even warmer thank you for supporting my efforts, regardless if you're a Patreon at patreon.com/AaronFlam, in one word, which entitles you to hearing the episodes a few days before the general public and don't have to suffer commercials, or if you're supporting me on PayPal with Bitcoin or via Swish, 0768943737, 0768943737. I commend you for contributing to the most relevant podcast in Sweden. This talk with Meir Finkel would not have been possible without your steadfast support, so thank you. Brigadier General Finkel has served as commander of the Dado Center 2014 to 2019. The Dado Center for Interdisciplinary Military Studies is a military studies department of the Israel Defense Forces aimed at operational level of war activities. During his military service, Meir Finkel commanded armored units, including the Chariots of Steel Brigade during the Second Lebanon War. He was also the head of the Army Concepts and Combat Doctrine Department for 7 years. Finkel has a PhD in evolutionary biology from Haifa University and a PhD in political science from Bar Ilan University. We discuss Israel's ongoing military operations in Gaza and northern Israel, as well as broader strategic issues related to Iran and some of its regional proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas. Enjoy.
Welcome to Deconstructive Criticism, Brigadier General Meir Finkel.
Thank you, Aaron.
It's an honor to have you. Brigadier General, what grade or rank of general is that, really?
First of all, I'm a reservist, so I'm Brigadier General Reserve, which means that I'm serving during wartime in a position in the IDF and practicing for it. And the rest of the time I'm researching military issues as a civilian. In the IDF, the Brigadier General is the rank of division commanders, commanders of what is called staff divisions in the HQ or in services and regional commands. I think there are about between 80 to 100 brigadier generals in active service in the IDF during every point. And I was a brigadier general during my regular service as the head of Dado Center, which is a kind of thinking accelerator for the operational and strategic levels of the IDF. And I was practically began my service as every Israeli soldier as a tank gunner, and then moved up as a tank commander, platoon commander, etc., until becoming armor reserve brigade commander during the Second Lebanon War in the rank of a colonel. And then I commanded the ground forces command, the concept and doctrine department for 7 years, which is an unusual length for a position in the
IDF. What is that exactly? Concepts and doctrine.
Concept is envisioning how the ground forces will fight in the future, and doctrine is how the ground forces are supposed to fight within combined arms, of course, with the Air Force and intelligence and all the services during war. So with doctrine, you practice and fight. With concept, you build the force for the future. And I was appointed to this position after the Second Lebanon War. And during that time, the IDF had to make a huge change after focusing for a few years on what was called then counterinsurgency, low intensity conflict in Judea and Samaria. The IDF surprisingly discovered that there are big engagements such as Second Lebanon War, and during those 7 years, I had to rewrite all the doctrine of the IDF to refocus it on war. After 7 years in that position, I was appointed to be the commander of Dado Center in the rank of Brigadier General for 5 years, dealing with many issues that are still under consideration, debate, thinking about. It was between 2014 and 2019, and in the last 5 years, I am writing a series of books on the IDF higher headquarters. One of them was published by Hoover Institution, Stanford University, dealing with the. It is the first book in the series dealing with the chief of staff of the IDF, which is for foreign audience, it's a kind of problematic definition, because the chief of staff in the IDF is practically the commander of the IDF. It is the commanding officer of the IDF. It is called the chief of staff.
Mm-hmm.
So
but he is the commanding officer.
Yeah, the commanding officer. And I wrote the first ever real research, not just documentation of what they did, but dealt with few specific issues. The first theme of the book was how to identify change in the strategic environment and shift the IDF to meet it. And I compared in this first chapter six chiefs of staff from those that succeeded to see the future and to prepare the IDF to those that neglected the reality, although it began happening. And I tried. Please.
You said you partook in the Second Lebanon War.
Yes, as an armor reserve brigade commander.
That's in 2006.
Yes.
Yes. Did the experience that you had from that war shape your view of the military, so to speak?
Well, I was a battalion commander in Operation Defensive Shield in 2002. I was shaped by long terms in the security zone, the Israeli security zone in Lebanon, and I served in Gaza, in Judea and Samaria. So 2006, as a brigade commander, was part of my military experience, and of course it was the returning of the wars, of big engagement, and it shaped my military thinking from this perspective. And probably sometimes each one of us, each person is shaped by some events in his life, and I hope I was not shaped too much by 2006 because next war were different. And usually we have a kind of, a bias towards the last experience that, and I hope the IDF will not see the war, the current war in Gaza as the war, because war in Lebanon will be very different. Yes, but it shaped my understanding about the ability of reserve forces to do their job. And you can see it clearly here in the war now. I have a son, the reservist infantry man. And
is he in Gaza?
No, in the northern sector. He was called up in 7th, like me, in the 7th of October noon to guard the border here, because we didn't know if the Hezbollah is beginning another attack or what's going on. I've got another son, the young one is still in his regular service, he's a tank commander in Gaza. So, okay. Yes. And practically...
Well, I wish them all the best. So did October 7 change your perspective on Israel's conflict with its neighbors?
In some aspects, one of them is the length of the war. And not from the perspective of, the basic perspective of Israel's need to fight wars. Because I think in the last years, the IDF were preparing mostly for a northern scenario and was very concerned with the Radwan forces on the border. And there was a preparation for war, but not war in Gaza, not in this urban, I would say, not in a city of more than 1 million civilians within, putting aside the Hamas. And not for this length, I think. There was a beginning of discussion about a multi-arena war, but it was focused, I think, on Iran and Hezbollah, not the situation that we are having here. So, of course, it shaped my understanding in the strategic level. For example, the issue of the length of the war that we have to prepare to fight, and then the tactical level on it's not exactly a shape, because the fighting ability in urban terrain that the IDF is doing quite well now, it's based on the decade and a half of intensive work about combined arms warfare in the ground forces, coordination and closer support. I began with that as the doctrine and concept. The one was responsible for this after Second Lebanon War. Streaming intelligence from...
What is that? What do you mean, streaming intelligence?
I mean that intelligence which is produced in the higher echelons of the IDF by strategic and operational level assets are streamlined to the company commander through the battle management system, this is the first employment of vast forces, all the IDF in the north and the south, based on what is called in 2006-07. And it was when it began, the army digital army project, transforming the IDF down to the company level and the pilot and every tank and every APC to a digital infrastructure. So the IDF is fighting now on the net with very good air support, with very good intelligence, and it is a product of a decade and a half intensive work since 2007. So I'm not surprised from this. It was a really long journey from 2006 until now. So there are issues that are new, the we have challenges with all kinds of drones and UAVs, but not in Gaza, is in the northern part, and there's a battle in the spectrum, and it's a never-ending story of, you know, measures and countermeasures. And
but you also have two PhDs, and one of them is in political science, right?
Three PhDs. You missed
three
one.
PhDs. Your army resume said two, so three. Which three?
Right, it's
evolutionary biology, political science, and
prehistory. I'm an expert in the last decade. I got my PhD, I think, in 2019. I'm dealing with prehistoric lithic sources, flint sources.
Okay. All right.
We had about
an archaeologist or
archaeologist.
Yes,
I'm archaeologist, biologist, but mainly dealing with military issues. The first are hobbies.
Yes, but also political science, obviously. So you must have a strategic idea of what you think Israel should do now when it finds itself in the situation it is with a new type of warfare in the north with UAVs and drones, and it's a tit for tat now in the north, right? But in Gaza, it's a major offensive.
Yes, it's now. Well, I don't want to refer directly to what the government should do because I'm still in service, although as a civilian. I agree with two basic issues. We have to eliminate Hamas as a fighting power and to get back the hostages. And there should be a kind of a political arrangement, a new one, that is putting whatever Hamas is now in a minor position of decision-making. And it's complex because, you know, it's very complex because many issues. The population that we don't want to harm, or we try to minimize the harm, the huge underground infrastructure that we try to deal with, the delicate issue of the border between Israel and Egypt, along Rafah, between the Gazan Rafah and the Egyptian Rafah. Not many knows that Rafah is practically divided by the Israel-Egyptian border. So within this complex and in the north, we hope, we don't want a war. The Hezbollah doesn't want a war, but it's on the edge of a war here all the time. Practically, I'm speaking with you from a village which is 5 kilometers from the border. Partly evacuated, the local security squad is, here from October 7th. Aged people, the young with the children are not here because the education system is not the kindergarten here was not operable for a few months, and there are schools in the region that are not opened yet, so. Families with children in those ages can come back, not because of the direct threat, but because the education system. So I hope and believe that we will succeed in both the military missions of what I said now, which are of course deeply involved within strategic and political decision making. I don't know for how long we will. Yes, please.
What about the northern border? Because you're that close to the border now, I guess, as a part of your service.
No, I live here.
You live there?
Yes, I live 5 kilometers from the border in a small village. Yeah. Yes.
And it's partly evacuated.
Yes, as I told you, yes. Mainly less because of the threat, mainly because of the education issue.
So in your expert military analysis, what is it that Israel has to do to move the people back?
I think there's a consensus that in order to do so, the Hezbollah fighters from all kinds, never mind the name of the unit, should be at least 10 kilometers north of the border. So there will be no risk for a kind of attack like in Gaza, no risk of direct fire by long-range anti-tank missiles, which is getting to 10 kilometers now. So at least 10 kilometers from the border. This is a must. Now, if the Hezbollah would fulfill the 1701 agreement, it shouldn't be here at all, but is here. So it can be done by diplomatic effort, which is done, as I understand, mainly by the Americans, but by the French and others, or we'll have to go to war, and that refers to the paper, that the short paper that I wrote, and we'll have to conquer at least, I don't know, 10, 15 kilometers, to include not only to finish not only the problems of direct attack into Israel with troops and the anti-tank missile, but also the high trajectory fire, the short range, that because of the range, we don't have any alert. Here in where I live, there's no alert because it's too short. You don't have time to go to a shelter. So this is a third problem. So we'll have to go inside South Lebanon and keep at least that part of the land that we conquer, and then use it as an asset for a political arrangement. Otherwise, there's only two options: either diplomatic or a war, in a scale that I cannot say what it will be. And the end must be that the Hezbollah cannot threat the border villages in the way it did until the October 7th, or it does now, mainly by anti-tank missiles, not because its forces move a little bit inside Lebanon after the long low to medium intensity campaign that is being done along the last months. But it people will not get back without any clear achievement or agreement that they can count on, that something like what happened in Gaza won't be possible to the Hezbollah again. And this is at least 10 kilometers north of the border without any Hezbollah troops.
I understand. I interviewed Zarit Zahavi.
Okay.
Of the Alma Center, and she seemed to be of the same opinion that Hezbollah needs to be demilitarized. And she and you were referring to the 1701 UN resolution that
yes.
Below the Litani River to the Israeli border should be completely demilitarized. Is that correct?
Yes, but yes, I hope so. But if not, the fully employment of this U.S. resolution, at least I think 10 kilometers it would be the minimum. It's better than south of the Litani, the full area which gets into, I don't remember exactly, to 20 kilometers from the Israeli border in some places will be fully evacuated. It's a problem to enforce it because Hezbollah is, using its forces without, sometimes without a uniform in the villages. It's not easy situation to enforce, but I think that if the Americans and maybe the French and the will guarantee something, and the Lebanese army, there is such army, will go down with much larger forces and do what it is supposed to do, to be on the border itself, as a state army and not giving the Hezbollah the place. So maybe it's possible. I think what is done in the last few months is practically trying to do so without a war.
Do you think it is a high probability that the Lebanese army will take on Hezbollah?
It depends on Hezbollah, if it will allow it. If
yes.
It can be done, if the Hezbollah will say, okay, I don't want war. I understand that there's no other chance that there will be no war other than my withdrawal from the border. And then he will let the Lebanese army. It all depends on Hezbollah and his, you know... strategic thinking is a complex one. Influenced not only by the military issue, but it's got his problems with the Shiite communities, which is
who Nasrallah.
Yes, it is basically a Shiite organization, and is based on kind of local legitimacy from the people who are living mainly in the south of Lebanon, and there are few I don't remember exactly the numbers, but I think 60 to 70 or 80 thousand people evacuated from the other side of the border because there's a war here. And of course, the Lebanese government and the Lebanese other, sect or pieces of the complex entity called Lebanon, which is composed of Christians and Sunni and Druze and Shia, and it's got all kinds of considerations in relation to Iran. So I hope that in the end he will fulfill the US 1701 resolution, and we won't need to begin a war. But we'll have to if he won't, because otherwise we won't be able to do what is the obligation of the IDF and the government of Israel, is to let people get back to their homes. And I want to remind that he began shooting after Hamas, in October 8th, he began
in support of Hamas.
Yes, not us. We didn't make the first. Yes. So, and I think it will be all get cleared if there will be a kind of ceasefire regarding the hostages in the south, and then we will see what his plans, how, whatever. I don't know. On the other side, I think that we are, it's the obligation of IDF, IDF, Supreme Command, and the Israeli government to do whatever it can before it begins a war in this region for internal consensus within Israeli, society, and also for international legitimacy. Now, when Amos Hochstein, the American delegate to the region, will say, okay, I did my best and it doesn't work, it will be a clear sign that we did our best as well, and it's, the diplomatic effort is over, and we have to go to other choices.
How do you see Iran's role in all of this? Because right now you're fighting Iran's proxy armies, and Iran is left unscathed.
Iran is behind all this. I mean, all this is, the Islamic Jihad in Gaza was directly supported as a proxy, okay? Hamas, partly. Look at the ammunition and Hezbollah, of course, the Houthis. So Iran is behind the whole concept and the net, okay, and the militias in Iraq and etc. etc. I don't know whether or not they ordered this, because I think as it was published, and I don't have any better knowledge, that they were surprised by this attack, like the Hezbollah, like others. But the problem is that the Western world. A big title, but I think that we all understand what it means, should find a solution to this nasty idea of sending others to fight for me and without being harmed.
But I mean, Western nations haven't gone to war for quite some time, and those who have has done a very bad job at it.
It should be other than, not everything. I fully understand the issue of boots on the ground. Okay, but there are others, and there were many, assets employed until now, like sanctions. But I think something other than sanctions should be done. And there was, targeted killing of Soleimani and et cetera, there are some things, but it's if there is a kind of a lesson for Western nations, and I'm not sure that our viewers or listeners will know what is called in Israel the campaign between wars. What Israel is doing for the last decade, let's say in Syria, to try to degrade sophisticated munitions that are moving from Iran into Lebanon, etc., etc. I think that we thought that this is will degrade the enemy's capability during war and will deter the enemy because our superior intelligence knowing exactly where the truck is moving or where exactly the munitions are handled in the shelter somewhere in Damascus. And I think that we thought it's kind of not only it's a kind of not solution for war, but or instead wars, or this is a kind of a new war below the threshold of a real war. What we learned here that it doesn't work. Okay, the enemy is sophisticated. The enemy is determined to grow and become a really big threat, and we cannot focus too much on the great capabilities during peacetime. But sometimes we have to go to wars. Either.
So that's the campaign between wars.
Yes, but I think the campaign between wars showed that its limit, meaning that sometimes you have to go to war, otherwise you will have what you have in Gaza. The hundreds of kilometers of underground facilities and thousands by thousands by I don't know how many thousands of RPGs and all kinds of whatever, and the Hezbollah got much more. And sometimes you have to go to war, and maybe sometimes that Israel used to do in 56, 67, 82 as a preemptive war, because you cannot let those organizations grow and grow without an end, and then be surprised in a surprise attack like was in Gaza. We thought and think in the last decade or decade and a half that there is a kind of compensation by the campaign between wars, and we discovered that this compensation is giving only a partly solution for the problem of the growing enemies. And maybe this is a lesson again for the Western nations. Okay, what's going on with the Houthis now? This is an international problem. Okay, they grew a little bit all the time with Iranian munitions. Believe they don't, their engineers didn't invent everything that they are shooting. Maybe they learned how to build it with Iranian knowledge, but I believe, I don't know the numbers, probably the vast majority of whatever they have is produced in Iran. But if you say, okay, they will not use it, or maybe we can, do something on the way, it worked very partially, we can say. And sometimes you have to go to preemptive, wars in order to eliminate the threat before it gets to this disastrous sizes. And I think maybe this is a lesson for the Western countries. It's not waiting and, thinking.
Okay, so more than mowing the lawn.
Before mowing the lawn, you have to do a big moan from 1 meter to 10 centimeters. And this is not...
Yes, I understand.
This is war. This 90 centimeters is war. And then...
Yeah. I think in English it's called the scythe, you know, the tool that you have to swing.
Yes,
you have
yes.
to use the scythe before you actually go to the lawnmower.
Yes, exactly. And this is what we did in 2002 in Judea and Samaria in Operation the Defensive Shield. After we saw that the Fatah then was, you know, with all the suicide bombs within Israel, and we got back into cities, and then since then we are mowing the lawn. And in Gaza, we let those, in this metaphor to a 1 meter height, we are not mm-hmm. now bringing it down to 10 or 20 centimeters, and then we'll continue to mow the lot. And unless there will be some political arrangement that will say, okay, you disengage in 2005. I want to remind everybody that we are not there for almost two decades. We disengage in 2005. Somebody will say, okay, I'm not interested in destroying Israel or going back to Israeli cities that we lost in 1848 because we didn't accept then the US resolution about how the Palestine should be divided. We didn't accept it and we lost. Okay, I'm not going to destroy Israel. I don't want to go back to Jaffa and Tel Aviv. Okay, I want to live in Gaza. Please help me. Okay, to focus on industry, on agriculture, on I don't know. It can be the most popular beach for European people who want to come to the Middle East. Okay, the Gaza shore. If somebody will say, okay, I'm interested in developing a country or nation, everybody will aid him. I hope that somebody will do it because in 2005 we gave Gaza to the Palestinian Authority, which lost it to Hamas. Later, killing the officials that were from the Palestinian Authority, and then since then they are shooting rockets, building tunnels, etc. If somebody would say, okay, that's what we have, we are going to live here, and this is our hall, and that's it, then things would be totally different, and we won't have to mow the lawn all the time.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem like it's going to be the case anytime soon. I mean, do you see any alternatives in Gaza?
I'm not an expert on the geopolitics. I'm more focusing on military issues. But there are problems for the Palestinian Authority. They've got functional problems. Let's call it functional problems within Judea and Samaria. So taking responsibility on another area is very problematic. And I agree with the Israeli political echelons, and the Americans understand it fully and asking for reforms. So this is a problem, but I don't know. Maybe kind of, I don't know what is the term in English of a committee, outside committee that is running a city that is not functioning by itself, something like that. I don't know. Composed of all kinds of non-military figures, Palestinians, Saudi. I don't know. That will say we are the civilian government of the area. We keep, assets to control the civilian to guard. Yes, which you need only, rifles and pistols and whatever. That's what happened in during the agreements in the 90s between Israel and the Fatah concerning Judea and Samaria. It didn't work very well, but some kind of organization will be a beginning. Until then,
In the last week, there's been two terrorist incidents in the West Bank or Judea and Samaria.
Yes.
Obviously, it's not a perfect solution.
No, not a perfect solution. But you ask if there's something, I don't know. But otherwise,
in this paper I read of you, you write that the era of wars of no choice have come back.
Yes.
But wouldn't a preemptive strike be a war of choice?
No, what I mean is that when you are the feel that you are, I won't say underdog, but when you feel you are threatened.
Yes,
threatened by forces, and which was the case until I believe 1982. Okay, until then we were fighting the Egyptians, which was 10 times bigger than Israel concerning population, etc. Or a combination in 67 of the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Syrians with forces from and air squadrons from another four countries on 73 against Egypt and Syria and Iraqi divisions and Jordanian forces. Then it was what was called a war of no choice. We have to, otherwise we will be wiped out. Now, since 82, we are kind of fighting forces that have lesser military ability than us, okay? So we went into another era of we are kind of the stronger forces, and it's another kind of military engagement. But when we are back in a multi-arena war, like against Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran, it's becoming again of a war of no choice. And in those cases, the issue of preemptive war is coming back to the table, because Iran got its, putting aside the nuclear issue, that thousands of long-range missiles and long-range UAVs that are practically used against Israel now, yes, by the Houthis, but they got huge arsenal of this, and in combination of them, next time maybe their lesson would be a more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Orchestrated combined attack on Israel, surprise attack, okay? It's to be a huge problem for Israel. So maybe the lesson is going back to 56, 67, etc.
A multi-front war. How many fronts are we talking about? We're talking about Gaza, West Bank, northern Lebanon with Hezbollah, Houthis, maybe Syria.
Yes, Syria. We've got there are Shiite militias in Syria. We got, I think,
and Iran.
Yes, and the Iraqi Shiite militias were shooting the Golan Heights also during this war.
Okay, so the Iraqi Shia militias go up through Iraq, come to the Golan Heights in Syria.
No, they are shooting. They are two different organizations. They are militias. They are shooting, sending UAVs and missiles from Iraq to Israel.
Okay,
and they are Shiite militias. Basically based on Syrians and all kinds of Shiite people from all around the Middle East, mm-hmm, in Syria.
Okay.
So two different organizations.
I see.
And there are also Shiite militias within Lebanon, which are not the Hezbollah, but in Lebanon. And there's Hamas in Lebanon. Okay. The Hezbollah is using Hamas in Lebanon also as a proxy of proxy. Sending them to the border is shooting his asset, he's not sending Hezbollah troops to infiltrate into Israel. He did it in this war a few times, but he sent Hamas operatives, people that went from Israel as refugees in 48 and live in southern Lebanon, and there are refugee camps until now. This is something that you have to deal with, you know, this amazing, never-ending refugee phenomena of Palestinian refugees, a third generation of refugees. They are never settling down like other refugees that saying, okay, this is my home. And so the Hezbollah is using two kinds of proxies, the Hamas operative from the camps in Lebanon, and Shiat militia, which moved from Syria to Lebanon. So the multi-front, it's Lebanon, Shiite militia from Syria, Shiite militia from Iraq, Houthis, Hamas, and Palestinians in Judea and Samaria, currently.
And Iran.
Yes, Iran, probably in the cyber and the other things, but not, I think, I don't know if they shot direct something. But when I'm talking about war of no choice, I mean that there will be an operational orchestration of shooting at the same time. Okay, from Gaza, it's going down, but from Lebanon and Iraq and Iran. Not only, you know, what's going on now, like each proxy is doing with limitation what he wants, but I think that the worst case scenario, okay, for Israel now, is a comprehensive, orchestrated, multi-front war, okay, done not only orchestrated, not only on the political level of, okay, you will do all kinds of things, but on the operational, tactical level. And this is something that brings us back to the war of no choice, that we, you know, sometimes bring you to the conclusion that you have to begin preemptive war before the enemy will surprise you.
Yes, because eventually he will grow so strong that you don't stand a chance if he chooses to attack.
Yes.
And I understand that Iran's proxies has proxies. So I read somewhere that Iran's defense or military strategy was threefold. First, proxy armies, it was missiles and nuclear option.
Okay.
So shouldn't you preemptively strike Iran before they reach the nuclear option and sort of fulfills its military ambitions?
This is a big issue that, you know, wasn't still on the table for a long time. We did it twice, you know, what is called the Begin Doctrine. Yes. Prime Minister Menachem Begin from 81 with the Iraqi nuclear facility that was built by Saddam Hussein and it was nearly operational. And then in 2007 with Bashar al-Assad nuclear facility. And still, the formal strategy is that we won't let any enemy country to have a nuclear weapons. And it was I think that Israel was saying to the world, that we won't have any. If there will be no international solution, we will have to do what we'll have to do, at least try to do our best. This is the... So I don't know exactly, and that's not the, what's going on exactly now concerning that issue. But of course, this is the highest concern of Israel is, Israel. Political echelons, military echelons, civilians, or whatever, in the last, 20 years. I think in 2006, Ahmadinejad said, I'm going to destroy Israel. Yeah. Of course, it began, the nuclear issue began, the facilities began before, but as we know now, and they stopped it after the American invasion to Iraq. But he said clearly that this is his vision. And since then, we are in the And they are the things that was that were done according to, as I am ordered to tell always when I'm interviewed, according to foreign sources, many things were done during the years. And the answer is yes. I think, you know, Israel is trying to convince the Western nations that this is not only an Israeli issue.
Yes, well, when you read the papers, does it seem that Israel is getting anywhere with that project?
I don't know exactly, you know, how to comment now on that issue. And but if you ask basically on preemptive wars, this is a good cause for a one.
Yes, I believe you're right. You wrote in the paper about capturing territory that you mentioned earlier.
Yes,
that capturing territory is not to develop real estate on, but you wrote that it was three things: painful loss to your enemy and to be used as a bargaining chip, mm-hmm. summarized in a quote, and I quote you now, sir, it's land, stupid. So that is to incur a painful loss in the enemy.
Yes.
Yes. And then it provides Israel with an asymmetric advantage. Would you care to explain that?
Yes. Asymmetry, every military organization is seeking asymmetry in war. Basically to take or minimize the major assets of the other side in order to prevail in the military engagement. So so this asymmetry can take many faces. The problem currently is that when you are talking about fires, the IDF Air Force, the Israeli Air Force, is known for its abilities, okay? And usually we had a superiority with Air Force. Look at the 67, 73, with problems against the surface-to-air missiles, Russian Soviet missiles. But practically, the Israeli Air Force is, through gaining air superiority, is able to employ massive fires on the enemy. This was used to be an asymmetry from our side because the enemy has got lesser capabilities. The problem is that Hezbollah kind of compromises this or compensates for this with hundreds of thousands of rockets of all kinds, with combination of statistical rockets, which you have to shoot many in order to do something, but in recent years with accurate missiles, with accurate UAVs, with short but very heavy, short range and but very heavy rockets with up to half ton or something like this, which can destroy everything that it target. So this combination kind of makes the situation concerning fires as kind of symmetry between us and the Hezbollah with different capabilities. We do it mainly with the Air Force. They'll do it mainly with all kinds of ground to ground assets. What I was trying to say is in this paper is that only we can fight, capture an area and hold it against counterattack and keep it until the end of the war. They can do it for a few hours, as everybody saw unfortunately in Gaza. They could have done it in the northern border if we were taken by surprise. Currently they cannot because we have much more forces now. But even if they can do something, it will be for hours or days until we take the ground again. We are the only one, like in Gaza, that can capture and hold the ground. This is an asymmetry from a military perspective, but what I'm saying, it's not only the thing that only we can do, but we can use it as a bargaining chip. And you can see it right now, because in what they ask, the Hamas is asking for as a beginning of the negotiation, is that you want the hostages back, go out of the area that you took. So it's a bargaining chip currently, and it should be used also in Lebanon and in every other area that we are fighting. We cannot, you know, This is, I think, it was part of Israeli military doctrine for decades. It went out in the age of counterinsurgency, fires against fires, but in this kind of wars, when there's no wars, you know, from the new kind, we need to use all our capabilities and assets, and this is part of the abilities that we have. And it's not only about killing the other enemy, the enemy, and go out, but keeping the ground again, not as a part of the Israeli, you know, territory and without the villages or whatever, not, but as a bargaining chip for political negotiation. What I mean is, if there will be a war in Lebanon and we'll get inside and clear the area for anti-tank missiles and Radwan companies and high trajectory fire, we shouldn't go out immediately like in Second Lebanon War. We should stay there, not letting the civilians that were fleeing north to get back, because the situation, it will be still a war zone and the facilities will be like in Gaza probably, where we will fight on the ground. And saying to the Hezbollah, to the Lebanese government and to the world, okay, now you want us to go out, now you go north of the Litani. Okay? So that's what I mean as a bargaining chip. I think that without this, again, going back to the midway of our discussion, if there will be no diplomatic solution before the war, so what I advise is that during the war, at the end of the war, we won't get out and saying that's what we did and we go back. We will stay there until there will be an agreement. And until then, like in Gaza now, we will have to stay there. It can take, you know, weeks, months, or years, like in the security zone in Lebanon. But we have to guard our civilians. If you want people to live on the border, and practically, maybe people doesn't understand the end of about 10 or more villages on the border is the border in Israel. It's not. You know, there's no, so the army have got huge problems in defending a village, which where the village fence is the border fence. There's no buffer zone, so we'll have to stay there until an agreement. And if there will be no agreement, the IDF will stay there, so the villagers will be able to come and live as they should. That was what I am saying. So
yes,
And because it went out of our military thinking, I thought it necessary to directly say it. Because the IDF concept had the kind
because,
of...
But the current government has said, internationally at least, that they have no interest in resettling Gaza.
No, I'm not talking... I'm not talking about resettling anyhow. But I think that the Israeli government is saying we are going to control the area from security perspective. So the meaning is that we'll have forces inside. And the meaning is that I probably within a few hundred meters, kilometers, whatever, in a perimeter around Gaza, nobody will get inside. Because we now call the civilians to go back to the outskirts of Gaza, to the Israeli places where they were massacred.
To the kibbutzes.
Yes, the kibbutzes and to Sderot. Mm-hmm. And in order to guard them, we won't let anybody, regardless, I think, of his age or whatever, to get close to the international border, let's say. Okay? So the meaning here is that we will secure the ground. And I'm not talking about settlements, not in Gaza, not in Lebanon. I'm talking
But it is a form of... You're saying that it is a form of occupation because Israel has the ground, so to speak.
Security zone, okay? Some kind.
So, again,
if there will be a diplomatic solution or international arrangement, we'll go out. I think that the Israel government wants to go out from Gaza. If there will be somebody, they will say, okay, I'm taking responsibility. Okay, I'm As I said before, I'm taking responsibility. I'm not interested in coming back to Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Jaffa, that were before 48 villages or small towns or whatever. Okay, I'm not in this business, and I'm in the business of building Gaza as a new
Dubai.
Whatever, yes. Until then, we'll have to do what we have to do in order to defend our legitimate kibbutzim on the border.
Yes,
that's the basic lesson. We are not the those that attack.
Yes, I was in Kfar Aza on Wednesday, and it was quite a sight. Basically, if Macron doesn't get a deal with the Lebanese government and they can't settle with Nasrallah, and Nasrallah can stand up to Iran, if they ever tell him to attack Israel, then there won't be a war in Lebanon.
Yes, and it should be something that the Israeli government can be sure that it will work concerning this agreement, and see with their own, we can see with their own eyes that it's being done, and see the Lebanese army on the border, and all kinds of things that can assure us and the people who live here, like me, that this threat of what happened in Gaza won't be an option. It's a complicated issue, but it's possible, I think. And that's the reason that Israel is waiting so long. You know, people are evacuated, are not at home for last almost 5 months, and still. And I think that they lengthened the period now until July, so we've got a few more months for this, you know, thing to become a reality.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if it will get into the summer and there will be no political, diplomatic solution, we'll have to invade Lebanon and do it by ourselves, you know. Otherwise, it's like
evacuate. So that's your time frame.
I think something like, I don't know. I'm not, you know, in the details. So what I think that we are waiting to see what Macron or the Americans are, you know, on the system is working on it.
It is very sad to hear, but I understand completely. I think because I saw the border with my own eyes up there. So,
not easy to live here in this neighborhood.
No, but you're staying, aren't you?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, you haven't evacuated.
You mean Israel?
Your town is just 9 kilometers from the border up north. So
no, five.
Five.
Where I live is 5 kilometers.
Okay. So you can see it quite clearly.
I can see it from the roof of my hall, the border.
Yeah.
No, but there are many Israelis that are evacuated.
Yeah.
Your
neighbors back.
Yes. My wife's parents are evacuated. They are from Yuval, Far Yuval, place on the border that civilians were killed. So her parents are evacuated for almost 5 months, and it's again, I think that you know, Israel will give a chance for diplomatic solutions for another few. I don't know exactly, you know, until when, and then there will be. I think there's already a consensus within Israeli society that, you know, if there will be no diplomatic solution, we will have to begin a war in Lebanon to do the minimum.
A war of no choice.
Yes, a war of no choice, and the minimum will be, you know, taking the Hezbollah few kilometers to a state that villagers can go back safely. So the IDF will stand between them, practically between them and the Hezbollah. And then, according to what I said, we have to stay there until there is a solution. And we have to use the ground that we occupied as a bargaining tool.
I understand. Well, I've taken up an hour of your time. I want to thank you so much for talking with me, sir. It's been an honor. I hope there is a diplomatic solution, but I am not an optimist. So,
yes.
להתראות, and עם ישראל חי. Thank you, sir.
תודה. תודה גם לך. ביי. ביי.
ביי.
Thank you for listening to Deconstructive Criticism. This episode's guest was Brigadier General Meir Finkel. But first, a heartfelt thank you for listening to Deconstructive Criticism, and an even warmer thank you for supporting my efforts. Regardless if you're a patron at patreon.com/AaronFlam, in one word, Aaron Flam with one A in Aaron and one M in Flam, which entitles you to hearing the episodes a few days before the general public and don't have to suffer commercials, or if you're supporting me on PayPal with Bitcoin or via Swish, 0768943737, 0768943737, I commend you for contributing to the most relevant podcast in Sweden. This talk with Meir Finkel would not have been possible without your steadfast support, so thank you. I am Aaron Flam. Until next, have a good unit of time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.